want to welcome everybody to session 172 of the 2017 Sunstone Symposium. It's wonderful to see all of you. This panel is called Extraordinary Ordinary Women, as you can see with the PowerPoint. It is sponsored by the Mormon Women's Forum. The forum was started in 1988 as a Mormon feminist group to provide a forum for discussion about women's and gender issues. So we've been around for a long time. I want to announce that we are going to have our Counterpoint conference again this year here at the University of Utah in Panorama East on October 28th. So look for some information on the Facebook site for that. I will introduce our panelists in the order that they're going to speak. Our first speaker is going to be Janice Allred. She's an independent scholar who speaks and writes on theological topics. She's the author of God the Mother and other theological essays, and she's actually the president of the Mormon Women's Forum. She will be addressing or giving an overview, sort of a theoretical overview of our topic. Our next speaker after that is Vicki Eastman. Vicki has been a frequent participant on Sunstone panels dealing with Mormon culture, and she's been a frequent participant with the Mormon Women's Forums panels and Counterpoint Conference. Professionally, she is a retired freelance executive recruiter. She's going to talk about some contemporary Mormon women. I will be third. My name is Margaret Toscano. I am an associate professor of classics and comparative studies here at the University of Utah. And I have published extensively on Mormon feminism since 1984, so I've been around a long time. And finally, and I'm going to talk about two 19th century Mormon women. Finally, we have Gina Colvin, who is a research fellow at the University of Canterbury, Christ Church, New Zealand, with an interest in cultural and post-colonial studies. She's an international editor for Dialogue magazine. So we will proceed in that order and go right into our topic. Thank you so much. Whoops.
Well-behaved women seldom make history. This well-known aphorism, coined by Laurel Thatcher Ulrich in 1976, has come to mean something quite different from what Ulrich originally intended. It has become in many ways a slogan encouraging women to pursue unconventional paths in order to be worthy of making history. However, Ulrich intended to call attention to the value of the ordinary life. As a historian, she was interested in mining the diaries, letters, and other artifacts of women's lives as a new way of writing history and understanding the past. She was interested in the well-behaved woman who didn't make history. Women's history is now a recognized field of study that seeks to recover the contributions that women have made and also to show how women lived in the past and how they were affected by historical events. Personal narrative, telling our stories for ourselves, for our friends and family, for a wider audience, and for posterity, is an important feminist value. We all love stories. From stories, we learn empathy for others, and we broaden our experience. Literature especially brings us into the inner lives of others. Fictional characters, created from the imagination and experience of gifted writers, help us to understand what it means to be human and how to find and create meaning in our own lives. In literature, we can explore ethical problems and dilemmas and learn to think seriously about questions of justice and mercy in the context of particular lives. Learning about the lives of women, both ordinary and extraordinary, helps us better understand our past, gives us insights into our own lives, and expands the possibilities that we can envision for ourselves. But does the ordinary life achieve significance only when it is narrated, only when it functions as a representative of larger groups and patterns? Does the individual life have value in itself? I would like to probe a little deeper into the value of the ordinary life. For the past 2 years, I've had the opportunity to spend a lot of time with my granddaughter, Iris, who is almost two. I love to observe how she views things and how she learns. Especially fascinating to me is the acquisition of language. Iris is working on mastering pronouns, but she hasn't quite figured out how to use first and second person pronouns. In the subjective case, she usually just refers to herself or the person with her by name. Iris wants to play. Grandma do it. But in the other cases, she has been referring to herself as you and to other people in the first person. She says to me, hold you, wanting me to pick her up. And she tells me, take off my glasses, when she wants me to take off my glasses and lie down by her. But she is starting to catch on. Thinking about first and second person pronouns leads me into pondering a mysterious but fundamental feature of reality. Reality is composed of numerous, perhaps infinite, centers of consciousness, subjects who think, feel, act, experience, grow, and learn. Each self is an I to itself, but recognizes that there are numerous other persons who regard themselves and refer to themselves as I, me, and myself. Reality shifts with point of view. Understanding that other persons are, like myself, subjects, and that I am part of the objective world to them, is built into the structure and grammar of all languages. Children are expected to master this complicated feature of language, and they do this around age 2. The possibility of empathy is grounded in language. Each person has intrinsic value to herself, for if she should cease to be, she would lose everything else she values. This does not mean that we always value ourselves or think of ourselves as persons of worth. What is the worth of a soul? What is the value of a human life? It is hard to develop a philosophical justification for the worth of souls, although democracies and free societies are grounded on the belief that all human beings have intrinsic rather than simply utilitarian value and are thus of equal worth. The ideal of fundamental human rights is grounded in this belief. The Declaration of Independence grounds this ideal in God's creation of all persons. All men are created equal and are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights. The Gospel of Jesus Christ teaches a firm foundation for human worth and equality. Remember, the worth of souls is the great in the sight of God. For behold, the Lord your Redeemer suffereth death in the flesh, wherefore he suffereth the pain of all men, that all men might repent and come to him. And he hath risen again from the dead, that he might bring all men unto him. He doeth not anything save it be for the benefit of the world. For he loveth the world, even that he layeth down his own life, that he may draw all men unto him. Wherefore he commandeth none that they shall not partake of his salvation. And he inviteth them all to come unto him and partake of his goodness. And he denieth none that come unto him, black and white, bond and free, male and female. And he remembereth the heathen, and all are alike unto God, both Jew and Gentile. In his atonement, Christ makes himself equal to each of us, drawing us to him and offering us eternal life in and through him. In making himself equal to us, he makes us equal to each other and seals our infinite, eternal, intrinsic worth. Jesus' parable of the sheep and the goats gives us a powerful rendering of this teaching. Jesus equates himself to the hungry, the thirsty, the stranger, the naked, the sick, and those in prison, those valued least. Accepting Jesus' atonement means recognizing the intrinsic worth of each soul by ministering to those who have no means of repaying us. I would like to tell you a couple of stories from my mother's life. She was an ordinary woman who would have found it difficult to list her achievements. Nevertheless, she was extraordinary. Her life was hard in many ways. She was the oldest of 10 children, her family was poor, and she was expected to play a major role in taking care of the home and family. She loved literature, art, and music and wanted very much to go to college. She was able to complete 1 year at BYU while working full-time to pay her expenses and support herself. Then her father asked her to quit school and help the family. She did so without complaint. It was the Depression and her family needed help. She learned many years later from one of her brothers that she had been offered a scholarship. Her parents were told, but they declined it, saying that she didn't need a college education and they needed her help. They never told her about it. My mother didn't marry until she was almost 30, and then she had 8 children in 11 years. She loved children very much and had great empathy for them. She regarded children as people with rights, and she always tried to understand their feelings and why they were doing what they were doing. She put her children's needs first and struggled to meet the demands of housekeeping. Her health was often poor, and she suffered from depression. She was more inclined to contemplation than action, more inclined to reading her children's stories than mopping the floor. My father worked long hours, sometimes at two jobs, and he was neither expected nor inclined to help around the house. Our family struggled financially. We were often very poor, and my mother had no outside help. For these reasons, our house was often messy and dirty. My mother was a very spiritual woman with a deep love for God and the scriptures. She loved the church, believed the gospel, and was committed to her church membership. However, she often felt judged and out of place in our ward. She didn't attend Relief Society very often, but she did on one memorable occasion. She told me that the lesson that day was on being prepared for the second coming. The teacher asked the teachers what they would do if they knew that Jesus was coming that night to visit them in their homes. "Wouldn't you clean your house from top to bottom?" she asked. "Wouldn't you want it to be spotlessly clean and in perfect order?" This made my mother angry. She said to me, "If I knew the Relief Society sisters were coming, I would clean my house," she said, "because I know they would judge me for having a messy house, but not Jesus. I wouldn't have to clean my house for him. He knows my heart, and he knows why my house is a mess, and he loves me anyway." Although my mother had great respect for church leaders, she did not regard them as infallible. In 1997, when she was 82, frail, and beginning to experience some dementia, she boldly went to church headquarters to protest two unjust church actions. My excommunication in 1995 was very hard on her. She didn't understand it, but she felt it was unjust. She also felt the excommunication of my brother-in-law, Paul Toscano, was unjust, and she determined to speak to an apostle about these injustices. This was before my sister Margaret was excommunicated. She asked me to take her. I didn't think I was the best one to do this, so my husband David volunteered. She didn't think an appointment was necessary. She was willing to speak to any of the apostles except Boyd K. Packer, who she regarded as too mean. She wasn't able to speak to an apostle, but they did find an area representative to talk to her. This meeting did not lead to a rectification of the injustices, but it was recorded in heaven as an act of courage, love, and a commitment to truth and justice. In 1983 and 84, my parents served a mission in the Dearborn, Michigan mission. My family and I were living in Michigan at the time and were able to visit my parents from time to time. One day, early in their mission, my mother called me and told me that she and my father were having a hard time and had decided to go home. This hit me very hard. I saw it as one more time when my mother wasn't able to carry out something she wanted to do. I asked her to wait a few days before notifying anyone. I told her that David and I would come to their apartment that night, and he would give each of them a blessing to help them to decide what to do. We did this, and they did complete their mission. And I experienced something extraordinary that night that gave me new eyes in seeing my mother. I only remember one thing that David said in giving the blessing to my mother. He said to her, "Someday your children will see you as you really are." I was surprised. Didn't I see my mother as she really is? I opened my eyes, which had been closed, and I looked at her. And I saw her dressed in pure white shining robes, and there was light surrounding her, especially around her head. "For the Lord seeth not as man seeth, for man looketh on the outward appearance, but the Lord looketh on the heart." I will conclude with a poem of my own, because I could not go to God. This is written for the lonely self seeking meaning, love, and hope. Because I could not go to God, he kindly came to me. He poured the tea. I passed the cake. He kept me company. Because I could not find the way, he shone his light for me, revealed the marvels of his world, and gave me eyes to see. Because I had no gift to give, he opened up his store and gave me treasures, old and new, and still he gives me more. Because the world was falling fast, my heart was full of fears, his gentle hand caressed my cheek and wiped away my tears. Because I could not cleanse my sins nor right the wrongs I'd done, he healed the ones I'd wounded and blessed us to be one. Because the troubled world pressed close with woes that would not cease, he whispered to my anxious heart, his spirit brought me peace. Because myself was very small and lost and set apart, infinity opened for me a place within his heart. Because I could not heal my wounds, he gave his life for me and with his blood conveyed my soul into eternity.
One thing I've really liked about this room today as I've been sitting in it is the view over the city, which has been, Margaret put down the shades so that you could see the PowerPoint presentation, but I've been looking down over that city, and right at this moment, the Outdoor Retailers Association is sponsoring a march from downtown up to the Capitol and a rally in favor of the Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument and the Bears Ears National Monument. I hope there are thousands of people there. And if I weren't here, I'd be there. I'm pleased to be able to focus today on women of courage and vision in their service in the LDS Church. To begin with, I'd like to honor my grandmother, Laverne Watts Parmley, who was the general president of the Primary Association from 1951 to 1974, making her the last primary president with real organizational power. As a child, I watched her pursue a career with an office, a staff, a travel schedule, large organizational meetings, a budget, a magazine, control over a children's curriculum, a pediatric hospital, and national recognition in the Boy Scouts of America. Often noted and lamented are the losses of the Relief Society to the correlation program in the 60s and 70s, but I wish to point out that other large women's organizations, the Primary Association in particular, suffered similar hard losses at that time. My grandmother was released after losing control of her organization's budget, its lessons and program, its magazine, and the Primary Children's Hospital, the successor of which is right through that tree over there. That wasn't the one she originally built, but that's the one that's there now, that is there now, and that is her legacy. Her successors as primary president have had little true power over the primary organization because they suffer from short tenures at the pleasure of male leaders. I'm sorry to see how different things are now. Her daughter, my mother, Frances Parmley Muir, has also had an executive career, but outside of the church, serving on the boards of large arts organizations such as the Los Angeles Philharmonic and the LA Center for the Arts. Regarding church service, my mother ultimately and famously said that she would not serve in any organization in which she did not have at least the possibility of being president. I love that about her. I love and honor my grandmother and mother for their abilities and the leadership model they've given to me, which I don't think I've really lived up to, but oh well. Today I'm going to tell you a lot about my dear friend Dee Dee Jensen, who is here with us in attendance, an extraordinary, ordinary woman, if ever there was one. I observed and served with Dee Dee in the Pleasant Hill First Ward in the San Francisco Bay Area, where I lived from 1973 to 1992. In the 1970s, Dee Dee was called into the bishop's office, I was probably not about 1975, and asked to accept the calling of Relief Society president. Her reply was, "No, that's not the calling you have for me." The bishop tried again with primary president, and Dee Dee responded, "That's the right one." She called me as her first counselor, even though she hardly knew me, and a great partnership was formed. Primary in those days was held on a weekday afternoon, which gave us a lot of latitude for innovation without being under the eyes of priesthood leaders. We had the building to ourselves. The kids came in play clothes. We could be physically active and do many things primary leaders can't consider these days, given the restrictions of a correlated indoctrination-heavy Sunday program. Dee Dee made the most of it. She formed a children's council from the senior primary children, one child per senior class, because she felt the children should have a voice in the primary. She gave them choices about activities and food, and they added their opinions to what happened each week. She called male teachers an innovation at that time, men who were free in the daytime. Once a month, we had a talk and sacrament meeting that was intended just for children. And I'll have to say that the adults liked that talk the best, too. Since the Worldwide Olympics were held during that time, we had a primary Olympics activity. We also organized a full slate of monthly in-service teacher trainings. One of those trainings we called GPCP, a mysterious code we didn't reveal until the last minute, that stood for Games Primary Children Play. Our silent counselor was Barry Manilow, whose songs formed the backdrop for some of our trainings. We stirred up a bit of controversy when we asked the Steak Primary, this was in California, for information and uplifting stories about the pennies we were dutifully collecting from the children on their birthdays. We expected something like the wonderful stories we had heard as children when the primary children's hospital was being built with our own primary birthday pennies. Imagine our surprise when we learned that the pennies we collected were going into the general Steak Fast Offering Fund and were not specifically helping children at all. We dubbed the whole affair Pennygate and began to withhold our pennies to give helpful gifts to children in our ward who were sick or in the hospital. At the end of this wonderful presidency, the counselors and secretary made a quilt for Dee Dee documenting many of the things we had done. I'd like to have Dee Dee stand now, and she has brought the quilt for you to see. Dee Dee, could I ask you two to come over here in front of this center aisle so most people can see it? This is Dee Dee and her husband, Dave. Do you want to say anything about anything on that quilt, Dee Dee? Oh, is that how that quilt started? Point out the GPCP. That was my idea, and I liked it. See, we did a little dinosaur dragon thing, because nobody knew what GPCP was. Yeah. Yeah, Daybreak was one of our, things. We had a really good time. Shortly after we were released, primary was moved to the Sunday block schedule, and many wonderful things ended. But Dee Dee and I stayed in primary by choice because of the constant opposition to the ERA that was a feature of Relief Society in those days. We called ourselves Relief Society Boat People, seeking refuge in primary from the ERA battle of the late 1970s and early 1980s, including the excommunication of Sonia Johnson. We were pro-ERA. We spoke up in favor of it, and we went to hear Sonia speak when she came into town. Subsequently, I went on to another calling, and Dee Dee finally did become the ward primary Relief Society president. Here was where she could really shine as a feminist, the more so because she had a sympathetic bishop at her back. Tired of the adulation of priesthood leaders, she put together a sacrament meeting program honoring the Relief Society and past ward Relief Society presidents. She and her counselors had an active schedule of visiting women in the ward and offering to pray with those women at home visits, the closest she could come to giving blessings by women to women with difficulties. She put together an annual women's retreat at a local hotel for women to get away by themselves for workshops and fun, on the theory that the other organizations had overnight activities, but not the women. The bishop supported the effort with scholarships for those women who couldn't afford it. Under Dee Dee's leadership, the Ward Relief Society formed a partnership with the Oakland Ninth Branch, a largely black branch over the hills in the flats of Oakland, where gunfire at night was not unusual. The Relief Society president there was a marvelous former drug dealer who often said that she'd given up a lucrative career to become a Mormon. She was something else. We traded homemaking meetings with the Oakland Ninth Branch. We taught them to decoupage, and they taught us to make sweet potato pie. We sang hymns to them. We sounded so honky. And they sang a rocking gospel song called We've Come This Far by Faith to us. When there was a fire in their ward, we sent food and clothing. It was a fruitful partnership among women, spearheaded by Dee Dee. There was a lot of talk in those days about praying to Heavenly Mother, a notion with which Dee Dee was comfortable. When she told the bishop she supported it, his response was, "Pray away." One of Dee Dee's finest moments came when a man in the ward spoke in sacrament meeting to the effect that he was sending his daughter to BYU because her main role was to find a husband there. Dee Dee stood up in Relief Society later that day in her wrath to say that the reason a girl should go to BYU is to get an education. I myself was the beneficiary of Dee Dee's experience and wisdom when I called her one morning at 7:30 a.m. after learning that my high school-age son had been arrested and had spent the night in jail. Because Dee Dee's son had had some problems, I called her for advice on how to get my son released. She then pronounced the single most memorable Relief Society sentence ever. "What kind of Relief Society president would I be if I couldn't tell you how to make bail?" Professionally, Dee Dee went on to become the head of education and outreach for a newly formed organization in the Bay Area, the Battered Women's Alternatives, a response by the Oakland Junior League to the newfound recognition in the 1980s of spousal abuse. She said this background helped her to look for deeper reasons when things seemed a little off with particular women in our ward. Dee Dee has the great good fortune to be married to David Jensen, a man who also stands up for women's voice and well-being. He was the stake executive secretary in the Oakland stake for many years and managed at one point to get Dee Dee and another woman appointed as assistant executive secretaries, which admitted them to the meetings of the stake presidency. The idea was way ahead of its time, however. Dee Dee reported, "We were in the room, but not in the game." A visiting general authority later put an end to this innovation. Later, as a bishop, Dave refused to assess ward members during Proposition 8, when the church was aggressively collecting funds to oppose gay marriage, saying that they could release him, but he wouldn't do it. Still later, as a private citizen, he performed a marriage ceremony for a lesbian couple. In truth, he is an extraordinary, ordinary man. Dave, would you just stand up again and give us a wave? As I think about what I know about people like Dave and Dee Dee Jensen, I see that they are out in front of the rest of us with better ideas and the conviction to make them work in the midst of a culture that does not often see things their way. Quietly doing things differently, working their will in surprising ways. I'm reminded of a poem by Alla Renee Bozarth, one of the first 17 Episcopal women to be ordained a priest in that church. It's called Water Women. "We do not want to rock the boat," you say, mistaking our new poise for something safe. We smile secretly at each other, sharing the reality that for some time we have not been in the boat. We jumped or were pushed or fell, and some leaped overboard. Our bodies form a freedom fleet, our dolphin grace is power. We learn and teach, and as we go, each woman sings. Each woman's hands are water wings. Some of us have become mermaids or Amazon whales and are swimming for our lives. Some of us do not know how to swim. We walk on water. I want to thank Dave and Dee Dee for all I have learned from them through the years about big new thoughts and standing up for human decency in all its forms. Thank you for stepping out of the boat and onto the water. Bravo to you both for lives of virtue and integrity. Thank you.
When I came into this room today, I realized that I forgot the first principle of good teaching, which is that you always go and scope out your room to know what your limits are going to be. So I have a PowerPoint today that really does add a lot to my presentation, but I realize that probably no one past the fourth row will be able to see it. So I'm going to try really hard to narrate so that you can get a feel for what I'm saying without, if you can't see the pictures, okay? Or see my chronology. But we'll do the best we can here.
I'm going to move so I can see.
Oh, yeah, if you want to go and see.
I'm going to be in the first four.
Yeah, go and be in the first four rows.
I'm going to be in the first row.
How about the first row?
Yeah. So my purpose today is to highlight the lives of two 19th century women. I don't know how many of you can act. Can you see the pictures? Oh, some of you in the back can. You have better eyes than I do. I wanted to look at the past since others are focusing more on contemporary women. My talk deals with two pioneer women you see here. On your left, I guess, you would see Cyrena Dustin Merrill. And on your right, you would see Jane Elizabeth Manning James. But before I start that, I want to do a very Mormon woman thing, which is apologize if anyone is offended. As we were organizing this panel, I intended to make it more diverse with more women of color and maybe a transgender woman. I was only going to moderate the panel. I put out a few feelers, failed, procrastinated, and here I am as a panelist. So my intentions were good. I know all about the road to hell. But my failure emphasizes central questions of our panel. Is one life more worthwhile than another? What makes someone ordinary or extraordinary? I am not sure I have answers, but I want you to contemplate these questions as I talk. I assume that many of you have heard of Jane James. Let me see the show of hands if you have. Oh, good. Look how many of you have. That's wonderful. Because a number of recent articles over the last few years, a play and a film that the church has shown at several church sites portray her life. She was certainly an extraordinary woman. She was one of the few African Americans in 19th century Nauvoo and Utah, which makes her unique. In spite of prejudice against her and many obstacles, she kept her faith, her testimony, and her charity. My relatives may be the only ones in this room who have heard of Cyrena Dustin Merrill. She is the first wife of my great-great-grandfather, Philemon Christopher Merrill, on my father's side. I am not descended from her, but from Philemon's second wife, Mary Jane Smith Merrill. But I became fascinated with Cyrena when I first read her short autobiography in the 1970s. In many ways, Cyrena is an ordinary Mormon pioneer woman. Her life is similar to many others, but she has amazing experiences too. I will first give you a brief chronology of each woman's life. Next, I want to highlight what they have in common, then contrast their differences. Then let you hear a few of their own words. They both have amazing little stories. And finally conclude with some speculation about our topic. I have juxtaposed, which this may be even harder to see than the picture, so I'm going to narrate this to you. I've juxtaposed a brief chronology of each woman's life on my PowerPoint to help you see the comparisons visually and briefly. So if you'll notice that Jane was born in, we don't know, somewhere between 1813 and 1822 in Connecticut. Cyrena was born in 1817 in New York. And then later her family moves to Ohio when she is a baby. Jane has a son in 1835. And I wish I had time to tell you this interesting story. It probably came from a white minister, and so it could have been an instance of sexual violence, but she is criticized later for this. She's converted to Mormonism in 1842, and she walks to Nauvoo with 9 members of her family. She gives a wonderful description of how much suffering they had to go through to get to Nauvoo. They ended up walking most of the way, which was almost 800 miles, because as black people, they were, even though they were free, they were all born free, it was very frightening to do that. And they arrive in Nauvoo in 1842. She lives at the Mansion House in Nauvoo with Joseph and Emma and Mother Smith, and she works there as a servant. So Cyrena was baptized in 1837 into the LDS Church in Ohio. She was the only one of her family who joined the church. She travels in 1838 from Portage, Ohio, to Far West Missouri to join the other saints, and she's with a group of Mormons. And they also had a very harrowing experience, a lot of pain and suffering getting to Far West, and just her loneliness at leaving her family behind is her big struggle. In 1839, she goes to Quincy, and then 1840 to Nauvoo. And there in Nauvoo is, in fact, where, and I don't know what happened to my, I better find it here. She actually marries her husband. She meets her husband and marries him in Nauvoo in 1840, which somehow got left out of my little chart. But that's important. And she's actually very happy she has a couple of children there in Nauvoo. And then in 1844, of course, Joseph sells the Mansion House, and Jane moves to Burlington, Ohio with her mother for a while, right before Joseph is killed. And both of them in their stories narrate the death of Joseph Smith and how traumatic that was to all of them. In 1844, after Joseph's death, Jane actually moves in with Brigham Young, and at that time she marries Isaac James. So Cyrena, I didn't put it on hers, but she marries Philemon in 1840. And then, of course, they all have to evacuate to winter quarters in 1846. At that same time in 1846, the U.S. government sent a call for people to join the Mormon battalion to go in the Mexican War. And Philemon, and this is very typical of him, Philemon was one of the 500 who went on this march from Iowa all the way to California. And so he leaves Cyrena with their three little children in winter quarters. And they're told, she's told at one time she can join him. She tries to go there, and then she has to return again. So it's a very hard, and she loses one of her babies. And this is going to be a theme in both of the women's stories, how many of their children they lose in death to various things. So at the same time, Jane, she's been married, she's at winter quarters, and she has a son, her son Silas, from her marriage with Isaac James. Now, I wanted to show you pictures. So you can see with Jane, we really only have one picture of her. And on the other hand is Isaac. You can see him. So you have the two of them. We have a number of pictures of Philemon and Cyrena, and I think it's interesting that we do. The one on your left is taken in the 1840s. You can see it by the costumes. He kind of looks like a Brigham Young lookalike, right? And then on the right is from the 1850s, and it's really interesting that he has binoculars. He was really an adventurer and explorer, and I'll come back to that. This is another one, and again, so this is on this picture. Let's see if I can see. The Philemon and Cyrena are on the bottom left corner with their children and daughters-in-law. So we go on. Jane is in one of the first parties that arrive in the Salt Lake Valley in 1847. You remember from we just had Pioneer Day, 1847. She's not in the very first company, but she's in one of the first. And they're still connected with Brigham Young. Her husband is working for Brigham Young. 1848 to 1860, she has six more children born during that period. Cyrena has to stay in Council Bluffs for 3 years because Philemon has gone all the way to California with the Mormon battalion. He goes to Salt Lake, leads a bunch of supply wagons back to Council Bluffs and winter quarters, and he leads like a bunch of parties across the plains for 3 years that she's there in winter quarters in Council Bluffs before she finally, in 1849, goes to Salt Lake, and they live there from 1849 to 1856. Now, Jane, in the meantime, she's going to stay in the Salt Lake area this whole time period. But Cyrena, with her husband, Philemon, who was in the Nauvoo Legion. He's in the Mormon Battalion. He's like this scout and adventurer and leader and a captain in the army, and he's off and doing all kinds of things. But Jane and Isaac, they stay in Salt Lake. In the meantime, Cyrena and Philemon are moving all over. But they live in Salt Lake for a few years. 1851, and this is interesting, so Philemon takes his second wife, which is Mary Jane Smith, my great-great-grandmother. Both Cyrena and Mary Jane have 8 children each with Philemon. Cyrena's children are born between 1841 and 1859. In 1853 to 1856, Philemon goes on a mission to England. And this is probably the hardest period of Cyrena's life. She's so poor, she takes in washing, she works in people's homes. She basically, if she hadn't have had people help her, she and her children would have starved. And her health is just completely broken down by the time Philemon comes back. And when he does return, they move to Farmington. 1869, Isaac leaves the family. We're not sure exactly what happens there, but he leaves, and he comes back finally to Salt Lake. 1870, we know that Jane married for 2 years to this Frank Perkins, and she got a divorce. It was fairly easy to get divorces in Utah. But the most important part of this part of her life, well, two things. She's raising her children. She's also struggling. When Isaac was in Salt Lake, they were quite prosperous for a while. But when he leaves as a single mom, she has a lot of struggles. But her biggest struggle emotionally is that she wants to get her endowments. She wants to have her temple ordinances. And because she was close to Joseph Smith, she feels like that she should be able to have them. And she keeps petitioning for them all through the 1870s and 1890s. I won't go through all the things with Philemon and Cyrena because I'm going to run out of time. But basically, they move from Farmington to Morgan City to Liberty Bear Lake County in Idaho to Soda Springs. 1871, Mary Jane dies. She had been very young, had only been married for 20 years. She leaves 7 children behind, and Cyrena talks about the responsibility of raising these children for her sister wife. 1873, Philemon marries a third wife. Cyrena doesn't mention her in her autobiography, and the only reason I can figure out is that it was the time when just to even know that you had a plural wife, you could be arrested. And she talks about Philemon going to Mexico. So here are the three wives, Cyrena on the end again, Mary Jane, the kind of strange-looking woman is the one I'm from, and Janice, right? She could have been pretty, though, right? I think it was a bad picture day. And then Rhoda on the right. And then finally, we're kind of at the end here, 1891, Isaac James dies. He's returned from Salt Lake. 1893 is about when Jane begins to dictate her life to Elizabeth Roundy. 1894, and finally the leaders, after she petitions and petitions, and to me this is one of the low points of church history, they perform, without her being present, a sealing of her as the eternal servant of Joseph and Emma Smith. And she, even though, I mean, can you believe that? I mean, it is so unbelievable. But she still does not give up. She knows that she should have her own endowments. And in 1905, she gives her memories to Susie Young Gates about the prophet. 1908, she dies. Cyrena, 1877, they go down to colonize Arizona, first Mesa, and talk about how hot it was, and then down to St. David in Safford, Arizona. 1893, Philemon and Cyrena come back to the temple dedication. 1897, Cyrena's 80th birthday, she begins her history. 1904, Philemon dies. Cyrena dies in 1906. Jane, and I think it's interesting, I have here a headstone that's put on later on Cyrena's grave, but notice that Jane's legacy lives on. 1979, finally after the revelation on priesthood and blacks, she's endowed by proxy. It just makes me cry. 1999, the Genesis Group puts a beautiful headstone on her grave. 2005, the Dr. Henry Field. 2010, a play about her. And so her legacy lives on. Here's her headstone. We don't have time to look at it. This is the one for Cyrena. I want to quickly now go and just, I have a little bit more to finish here about some comparisons and conclusion. Let me draw some comparisons between Jane and Cyrena. Their lifespans are the same. They very likely could have met both in Nauvoo and Salt Lake City. Both Cyrena and Jane struggled with the poverty and basic survival issues that settling new territory always involved. They both worked as servants in others' homes, though it had a very different meaning for Jane as an African American. They both loved the prophet Joseph Smith and died with strong testimonies of Mormonism. They both outlive almost all their children, which, of course, is an ongoing poignant grief to each that they emphasize in their history. Only one of Cyrena's 8 children outlives her. Only 2 of Jane's 8 do. Conversion and gathering design stories are important to both women. We know about them because they tell their own stories. They both record their lives when they're about 80. Cyrena's life history is 6 1/4 pages single-spaced. The first half is all about her conversion and movement to Nauvoo, but she does give more details about the rest of her history than Jane does. Jane's autobiography is about 5 single-spaced pages. Like Cyrena, she focuses on her conversion and the Nauvoo period. There is less about her long years in Utah, though there's evidence that she was a respected member of the Salt Lake community. She and her brother Isaac actually had reserved seats in the tabernacle for all meetings. The center of Jane's autobiography is her close connection with Joseph and Emma Smith. This is very important because it is tied to her belief that she deserves to be endowed and equal in the church. Perhaps she feels uncomfortable to talk about her conflict with leaders in her life story. Her description of her love of Emma and Joseph and their kindness to her seems to stand in for that central missing piece of her story. It gives a strong narrative reason against racism in the church and for her place within God's kingdom. She knew that Joseph had something else for her. Jane seems to have had a troubled marriage, but her greatest grief is over the church leader's denial to her of the endowment and sealing ordinances, which are vital for her. It is interesting that Cyrena mentions in her short history her endowment in Nauvoo, in the Nauvoo Temple, her sealing to Philemon in Salt Lake, and her second anointings in the St. George Temple, and the ordinance work for her own family who never joined the church. These ordinances were very significant to both women. They saw them as connected to their salvation and happy reunion with loved ones in heaven. Jane is denied and longs for it. Cyrena gets these ordinances as a matter of service. The 3 things that seem the hardest in Cyrena's life are her loneliness from her husband's ongoing absence and church travels. And in fact, not the polygamy, but his absence for his church travels. The family's constant moving and the struggle for survival, and especially the deaths of her children. Cyrena seems to have a good relationship with Mary Jane, and there's a clear, very affectionate and respectful relationship between Cyrena and Philemon. So the picture here highlights these women's struggles. Jane on the left, can you pick her out as the African-American woman, the black woman? She's the only woman among so many white people, but this is important. She saw herself as a fellow saint. Cyrena is here by her beloved husband's side. He's very dashing. But how much of her identity was always subordinate to his? Both women give their testimonies at the end of their life stories. For them, their faith validates their sufferings and their trials. Cyrena ends, "Now having lived to reach my 81st birthday, I filled about testimony, perhaps my last, of the truth of this work in which the Latter-day Saints are engaged." I wish I could read you longer, but I'm running out of time. But she goes on and tells about how, you know, happy she is that she has endured through all of her trials. Jane also ends her story with her testimony. "I am now over 80 years old and I am nearly blind, which is the greatest trial I've ever been called upon to bear. But I hope my eyesight will be spared to me, poor as it is, so that I can go to meeting." And then she also bears her testimony that her faith is stronger than even the time when she joined the church. Both Cyrena and Jane were extraordinary and ordinary in their own ways. It sounds rather like a cliche, doesn't it, to say that everybody's extraordinary. Aren't we all special? And yet so many billions of people have died without leaving any record of their lives at all, not even their names. The Population Bureau estimated that in 2015 there were 108.2 billion people that have lived on this planet, and with 7.4 billion living today. I'm not sure how accurate this is, but it's a very staggering number. And yet it doesn't come close to the sands of the seas or the billions of stars or cells in our bodies. Enoch is astonished that God weeps over his creation and asks why. The Lord answers, it is because we are his children. In the New Testament, Jesus says that God notes each sparrow that falls, and he numbers the hair on our heads. You are worth more than any number of sparrows, Jesus concludes. These are incredible statements that are hard to believe or comprehend, given the enormity of it all. And yet, I can believe because even I can feel the worth of each life when I see people's faces, read their names, and hear their stories. With the internet, it almost feels sometimes like there are too many stories. Anyone can have a voice today, but who will listen and care? Today we are here to validate the lives of all Mormon women, no matter their color or gender identity. I wish we had been more inclusive, but everyone we have talked about today is worth remembering. My last picture is my mother, Lena Peterson Merrill. And if you don't know, I'm Janice's sister, so all the stories she told, this is about our mother. Doesn't she have beautiful hair? The picture was taken when she was in her late 70s, I think. I spent the first half of my life doing my best not to be like her. She lived a thwarted life in many ways and spent many years so depressed she couldn't get out of bed. And so it was only until later in my life when I began to appreciate her and see that she was a woman of great faith and courage. She endured and never gave up. I want to honor her today and all other women like her who have lived their lives in obscurity. I believe firmly that the worth of all souls is great. Thank you very much. We have one more panelist. 15 minutes. It's fine. It's too much time. 8 minutes.
Te mea tuatahi ka nui tōku mihi ki ngā ātua i te rangi ko rangi nui ki runga ko papatuanuku ki raro. Kia koutou tini mate, haere, haere, haere e ngā mate. Haere atu rā ki te poho o ngā tūpuna, haere atu rā ki te noho, kei wainga nui i te aroha o tō tātou arekiko i hukareiti. Nā reira, kia koutou katoa no, tēnā koutou, tēnā rā tātou katoa. Now, I gave an introduction that ushered the deceased on, just in case they were hanging around us, because I'm about to talk about my mother. My mother, Marie Lucien Colvin, who was born on the 29th of July, 1948, and she died on the 4th of November, 2004. I usher her on because I can hear her say, oh, Gina, don't say that. This is my tribute to her extraordinary ordinariness. And I need to make an apology to begin with, that this may trigger some people. My mother was sexually abused by her elder brother's friend when she was a teenager. So when the first flushes of my mother's young desire began to explode in her later teens, there were no disincentives. She was already stained and worldly, already spoiled. And so in her adolescence, my mother threw herself at her male contemporaries without restraint. And by the time she was 18 years old, she was unmarried and pregnant with me. She joined the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints a week before my birth. My father, or I should say semen donor, encouraged her to have me adopted, and she refused, and they broke up. Well, that's her story. She chose me over over him. And as much as she liked my father, the prospect of motherhood intoxicated her and grounded her. And this young person, so freshly come into womanhood, was required to make a decision that would have profound consequences for both her and me. And as a child, I recall her telling me over and over again, when they placed you in my arms, I said, she's what I've always wanted. I'd given her reason to be present in this world. And though she would spend the rest of her life between sanity and insanity, between life and longing for death, between being present and trying to escape from the present, between fantasy and fiction, I knew she loved me completely with whatever capacity she was able. I first learned of my mother's spoiled girlhood, not just through murmurs, but also through my daily encounter with her body that gave some of her story away, albeit in pieces. I watched her body grow into adulthood, yearning for the kind of companionship that would never materialize. I was there for her marriage to the wrong man. I was a bridesmaid. Ugh. I saw her imprudently pregnant four more times, one to my sister Sasha, who was very disabled. I saw her body ravaged with self-loathing. I saw her body unkempt. I saw her blossom. I saw her wilt. I sat over her body unconscious and perforated with IVs and drains, beset by an illness that seemed the result of her wretched mental as well as her poor physical state. I saw her many, many tears. I watched her drooped in depression and cocoon herself in the mindless drivel of television and the comfort of food. I saw her die. I saw her prematurely dead. In fact, I packed her into her coffin. It was cheap. I feel sure that my mother's sexual abuse played a role in eventually ending her life. There was so much shame about her abuse given and received that she couldn't speak of it. And I think that all of her talk about wanting to die were a plea for help that would never come. And so as a result, she was often unreachably sad, as if the tendrils of her unhealed abuse were still there, quietly wrapping around each of her organs, putting her happiness in suffocating shade and finally snuffing out the light. Not that all sexual abuse victims are, as a matter of course, insolvably ravaged for the rest of their lives. This is my mother's story, but this is not her only story. My mother joined the church, as I said, when she was pregnant with me, and for the most of the rest of her life, she was a devout Mormon. Now, it was in this church space that she would often show up magnificently. For all of the trauma she lugged into adulthood, she was often beautiful and transcendent in this one place. She spoke with confidence and conviction about the church and its sublime effect on the human soul. Without a single exception, she loved and was beloved in the Mormon church. Her attachment to a benevolent, loving, eternal father was palpable and personal. I saw that her faith wasn't casual, and neither was it held with a tight fist. She was so blindsided by the beauty of the Mormon message that she was always open to the wonder of something more. And she was blessedly unorthodox. I don't think she meant to be, but she was. She had sought through the words of prophets, seers, revelators, bishops, and presidents to find the ones that suited her. And when she put all of those words together, they came out of sync with the Mormon world that would eventually socialize me, or try and socialize me, to worry and fret over these blurred religious and social lines. And when I was dating Alden Tanner's grandson, yes, I did. I escaped a bullet. He asked me why my mother hadn't updated her Bible to the new church edition. His question felt like an accusation, and I felt embarrassed by this mother of mine who assembled her religious doctrines out of old boxes lovingly filled with uncorrelated materials from the 1960s and 70s, The Instructor and other books and things by Leon Skousen, when there was the shiny new doctrines for purchase at the distribution centre. But looking back, I love that she either dared to be different or was far too much of a misfit to see how she was getting it wrong. Having said that, my mother was a single woman in a church and she wasn't instructed in the inner sanctums and she had no husband to check her more ingenious readings of Mormon doctrine. But at the same time, as Mormonism gave her a community and a purpose, I noticed that it haphazardly set up traps for her that she blustered into with absolute trust. It promised her a temple marriage when there would be none. I don't think she actually had a temple marriage. It may have been, but I'm not sure. It promised, there's a long story. It promised her prosperity when that would never be realized. It raised the bar on her behavior and habits that she would have to exert a taxing effort to achieve because of her past. She was someone who needed time and gentle nurturing to
habituate healthy and orderly personal practices when the church was all about urgency. I saw her lag somewhat in trying to keep up with a Mormon way of being in the everyday that honored mental discipline and hard work. And while being Mormon allowed her to inhabit this searing vision of eternity in some respects, it also lubricated her exit from mortality. It gave her somewhere to imagine and live for that suspended her in life, where she sometimes fell into a kind of dormancy waiting for her call home. My mother was also depressed. Living with a depressed parent is like being a passenger in a car you might crash at any time. As a dependent child, I was stuck with her as my only form of transportation into maturity, yet sometimes I'd turn around and only to find that she'd left the driver's seat. I recollect a bout of Mum's depression when I wasn't much more than 4 years old. We were living in this flat in the city, just her and me, and she'd recently checked out of maternal and domestic responsibility. Over several days, I'd watched dirty dishes mount on the bench, gradually coming to fill the sink until the small kitchen seemed stuffed with filth. I'd never attempted the dishes on my own before, I'm four, but I was desperate to get the home in order. I found a chair, I heaved myself up on it and filled the sink to overflowing. Bubbles and dishwater cascaded over the sides and slid down the cupboards onto the floor. As I tried to manage these heavy pots and pans that felt bigger than me, I remember the tears slipping down my cheeks as I wept with frustration that I was making the mess worse, that I simply couldn't scrub or claw away the dried dirt, that I was too tall on the stool and I was too short on the floor, and finally, there was no alteration in the untidiness. I just happened to make it worse. I think the noise of plates and pots and noisy motion must have aroused my mother from her bed, because she eventually appeared in the kitchen, scooted me out of the way with a smile and a hug, wordlessly refilled the sink and did the dishes while I tried to keep up with the drying. I remember the relief that she was there, that she knew how to fix things even when things were hard. My observations about my mother are not my mother's only story. These are simply my stories of her, my own scrapbook imaginations of a life I was bound to but didn't live. But the complexity of my mother's story and her death in all of our mother's stories does not make them unmentionable and shouldn't silence any attempt to make sense of our life together. Her story, with all of its messiness, makes it no less filled with meaning or any less worth telling. Rather, it makes all of those stories wedged in agonizing convolutions more important to tell, because those stories between the stories, those stories and the blind spots and shadows, the stories that give birth to a new organization of our words and thus our thoughts, need to be told, because in telling them, somewhat of our full humanity is claimed and my mother's dignity is claimed. I started this story with my mother's sexual abuse, not because it is definitive, but it's to say that it's impactful in the way that it tied up her body and her soul in knots and caused her to drag me with her through some very treacherous territory that sometimes put my body and my heart and my soul at risk. But it isn't the story of either of us. To only understand my mother as a victim and me as the victim's daughter dehumanizes both of us, for we were made of more ingredients than that, she and I. She is not, nor am I, a single story. Mine is not a miserable, I don't want pity for my story. It's not a miserable story held over me to remind me that I wasn't the result of the joyful anticipation of expectant parents. Sure, I was unplanned, a mistake, but I wasn't unwanted. And that has been a blessing that has given me the courage to live with paradox. My mother showed me with every caress and kiss with how she held my young girl's body with such profound affection that someone damaged need not damage, that someone illicit is not unworthy, and that you can reorder the cruel boundaries of the world with love. She showed me that love could give you the courage and compassion to look a cynical world in the eye and refuse to accept its meanest conclusions. Thank you.
Minutes, And so you can ask questions, make comments, but I also think this is a good time for you to tell stories of extraordinary, ordinary people, not just women, that you want us to remember, because I do think that in telling these stories that we honor these people and remember them. So let's start. And we want to get it into the microphone. I think we have two of them here. I think they're both on. Let's see how long the cords are, but I think you'll have to come up here, okay? Or you can stand there. So come on up. Yeah, please. And try to keep don't go on and on, okay? So we have time for a lot of people to talk.
She must have known my name.
Right?
My grandmother was born in 1897 in Moab. She was the first graduate of Grand County High School. She attended Brigham Young Academy. She was called home after the death of her mother because her father was injured, and she was now going to be taking care of her four younger sisters. She had eight older brothers and sisters, and they were original pioneers of that area. She married a man against her father's wishes, and she lost him in a mining accident in Castledale. She drove a Model T from Moab to Salt Lake City by herself in the first 2 years that Model Ts were in the southern part of the state. She opened a boarding house on 4th South. When my mother came, she showed me all the places that they had lived as itinerant, poor children, where I had friends who said, "Let me take you up to the clubhouse and show you where, when I was a little girl, we had dancing classes." My mother showed me the houses two blocks away where they were taking in boarders. Oscar McConkie used to walk past her boarding house and say, "Olive, why don't you go back to Grand County where you can live on a subsidy?" And she said, "My girls will never be raised by other people's charity." So she went to the, she trained herself as a beautician. She bought a permanent wave machine, which in those days was this huge outer space thing. And she drove down to the Navajo reservations and gave women permanents and traded for squashes and blankets and brought them back during the Depression and bartered in the city to be able to feed her girls. My mother, my aunt used to say, "Your mother made me stand on the bare place in the living room when somebody came over because we didn't have a chair and she didn't want to be embarrassed, so I had to stand in the bare place." And the point of this is my grandmother, when she was elderly, who was very dear to me, I can remember her saying, "I've never accomplished anything." And I looked at her and thought, "You have accomplished everything. I am so grateful that I have such an ordinary grandmother." And for those of you who do, I hope you're grateful as well.
What is her name?
Her name was Olive Woolen. Her name was Olive Bailey Woolen. Olive Wilcox Bailey Woolen. So probably we're related.
Oh, there's a lot of people here. I wanted to talk about my mother, who it took me a while to realize how incredible she was. She was born in 1917, and she and her twin sister started life at like 2.5 pounds. And her mother had toxemia, so my grandpa had to drive them around the wagon to get nursed. But they both grew up, and the other sister, they all grew up to get incredible educational accomplishments. My mom ended up getting a PhD in organic chemistry. Her sister became a psychologist at the VA hospital, and her other sister became the head of the health center or whatever at the University of Utah. And it was, a lot of it was because of her father. Her father, they had three girls, and he adored them and just let them go, you know, let them do what they wanted to do. And when I was young, I kind of knew that I had a different kind of mom because she worked, she taught chemistry, you know, and I knew that I had a really different mom. Back then, nobody else's moms worked, and this is in, you know, this is in Connecticut where we were hardly any Mormons. So nobody's moms worked, and the Mormon mom worked. She was the only one of my friends I was the only one of my friends who had a mom who worked and outside the home. And when I was a child, I resented it because I was one of the younger kids, and I didn't feel like I had a real relationship with her. My older sister pretty much raised me, and so I didn't appreciate how amazing she was. And how this was so necessary for her to go out into the world after 17 years of having 8 kids, you know? I mean, after 17 years home, having 8 kids. And she needed to get out of the house and do something more because she hated housework. But that's, you know, I didn't understand for a long, long time how amazing she was.
Could you tell us her name?
Okay, I'm sorry, Mom. Names,
right?
Margaret Clark Olson Hunter. But she was called Peggy.
Great.
I want to talk about my mom, too. She would definitely say she's an ordinary woman. I spent most of my life not thinking of her as a good role model. She raised her children thinking that motherhood was the role for women, and I was really resentful of that when I grew up. And so in my mind, she was just this person who, like, all she wanted was motherhood for me. And I can see now that she just wanted, that's what she knew. But I look back at her actual life, and I realized in the last couple of years that she's an amazing role model. I grew up poor, and my mom occasionally had to work, and she hated it, but she did. When I started high school, my mom went back to school because she wanted to help pay for me to go to college. She had always been really good at tinkering at things, and she would, like, we were broke. If something was broken, she took it apart and tried to fix it because we couldn't afford a new one. So she went to the community college to learn how to fix VCRs and TVs in the 90s. And the teacher there was like, nobody's going to pay to fix their TV or VCR anymore. They're just going to buy a new one. He's like, computer repair is next door. Everybody go over there. And she did. And she got an associate's fixing computers, and she worked at she got a job at the community college after she graduated, so that my first 2 years of college was at the community college because it was free because she worked there and she did all of that, so I could go to college. She then went and got her bachelor's, and now she'll be 60 next year, and she is one of the main IT techs fixing computers at the big hospital in St. George, and I think she's amazing.
What's her name?
Oh, her name was Lucinda Pace, and then Lucinda Pace Briggs when she got married, and they got divorced, and now she's Lucinda Pace Shumway.
No accident that we're having a lot of mother stories, right? Does anybody else have a story they would like to tell? If not, I will turn back to the panel and ask you whether or not there is sort of a closing statement or something that any of you would like to say.
Oh, I kind of want to say something. I think my, was it working?
It's not here.
That working? Oh, now it's working?
No.
All right. Yeah. Okay. I think that in many respects, my mother set me up to be mothered by other women, and Mormonism has given me a whole list of beautiful, beautiful women who've stepped into the gaps. And I think that's one of the beauties of the tradition. I just want to give acknowledge my grandmother and Audrey and Marion and Mari and Shirley, my mother-in-law, and Kim Turner, who's not here, who have all stepped up to be kind and loving mother figures for me.
It's really interesting to me that so many of us in this forum where we are talking about an ordinary woman who we see extraordinary want to talk about our mothers. Because I also noticed a theme for many of us, which was we did not view our mothers as anyone extraordinary at first, but as time has gone on, we see the value in their lives. And I was thinking, our mothers are the first person that we look, they look into our eyes, we look into their eyes. They mirror us, we mirror them. And I was also thinking of the broader role of the mother in heaven, who I think we have dismissed and devalued and have seen as not even a person. And I find some of us now are wanting to know her. We've asked for the name. We want to know the name. We want to see her face. We want to recognize her value in our lives.
I think it's interesting that I completely agree with what both of you have said. Another aspect of this that has come to me as I've heard these stories is the fact that it's very easy to see value only in the terms of kind of worldly success, right? That, yeah, you make history, right? You're in the history book. You have a degree. You have a, you know, you're the president of a CEO of a company. It's hard for us to see value in the ordinary, in the everyday, and yet really that's where we live our lives, right? Every single one of us lives our lives in the ordinary every day. And if we can't find meaning in the ordinary, it doesn't matter how many accolades we have, we will feel empty and not worthwhile. It's the interiority and the sense of our inner personhood that finally that's where we have to find meaning and value in ourselves. And that has come out to me very clearly in these stories, that we have to think about the value of people and accomplishments in a very different way. Anybody else? Well, thank you so much for your attention. We really appreciate you coming.